Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as you know, the show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. Now, let's kind of dive into where we kind of left off. But before I do, let me just give you a couple little reminders. These aren't obligatories, but we do have a YouTube channel. I haven't scheduled, but I will this week. I will have my next appointment with the county commissioner scheduled so that we can kind of get back to where we were. And what we want to do is we want to cover the nullification, and then we're going to cover the importance and the configuration of the county and how the state was truly dependent upon this county government. You got to understand, government was not involved in every facet. This is one of the reasons why even the state government wasn't in session all year. I mean, the governor, you know, was in office and he kind of was the executive. But whenever they needed laws or the legislation, the government would have to call on them to basically come in, or that they would have to, you know, kind of like have a percentage of the legislators agree that they needed to come in to do something. But for the most part, they weren't to be this big tax on the people. The constant government that existed in our life in those days really was the county. Your sheriff kind of kept the peace, and you had a board of supervisors or a board of commissioners, with what we call today, but they kind of maintained the local laws and they stayed within the framework of the state laws. But this is where they would create laws of whether you could, you know, have prostitution or you know, whether they enforced kind of like blue laws or what have you. And so you got to remember that they just didn't have lots of laws. What they had was they had churches, and everybody went to church, and everybody was, you know, if you did something that was inappropriate, you know, and we're not talking about serious laws or what have you, just lied to somebody. I mean, what happens when somebody lies today? Well, nothing. But back in those days, you were shamed. If you were dishonest in your dealing, you were shamed in the community. Now, there's no, you know, there's no case in court today where, you know, because our courts would be packed and stacked with that type of behavior. But it was the morality of the people that maintained what I would say these qualities of the mores, you know, the morals of what was really going on. You know, what actually was transpiring was driven more by the goodness of the people. This is what Alexis de Tocqueville noted, and this was in the 1830s. So in other words, you know, America was on this, you know, this track of enlightenment because America didn't need a lot of laws. They needed, you know, government to be there to protect their property and their life, you know, but that's it. They were able to operate without stealing from each other and without, you know, having these bad paradigms because they had a good, righteous paradigm. And they believed in liberty. And remember, Adam Weishaupt, his mode of operandi, the way he was going to permeate himself and this godlessness into our society, was they were going to use the tolerance of Christianity. It became very evident that righteous people needed to be tolerant of sin. They were not to, you know, the concept of not judging and kind of lightening up on people who had problems. So if you were basically operating decently, what seemed to be decently, nobody knew your evil designs and nobody would ever know. And that's how they permeated into our society. That's how the Fabians in the late 1800s were able to come here and actually be successful in taking over our education system, our politics, and everything else by the early 1900s. So with that, let's get into what Mr. Dawes was saying regarding standing armies and so forth. And we kind of just talked about, and we read this yesterday, but it's just a little portion that I'm going to reread. Those who never objected to such an authority in Congress as vested by the old Confederation surely ought not to object to such a power in Congress, where there is a new branch of representation arising immediately from the people, and which branch alone must originate those very grants that are to maintain an army. When we consider that this branch is to be elected every 2 years, there is a great propriety in its being restrained from making any grants in support of the army for a longer space than that of their existence. If the election of this popular branch were for 7 years, as in England, the men who would make the first grant might also be the second and third for the continuance of the army. And such an acquaintance might exist between the representatives in Congress and the leaders of the army as might be unfavorable to liberty. But the wisdom of the late convention has avoided this difficulty. The army must expire itself in 2 years after it has been raised, unless renewed by representatives who at that time will have just come fresh from the body of the people. Possibly. I mean, we get these career representatives as well. It will share the same fate as the temporary law, which dies at the same time mentioned in the act itself, unless revived by some future legislature. Now, they've gotten around this. They acquired the ability, Congress acquired the ability to actually create a permanent army, air force, and so forth. It's not like they're fighting wars. Now, they do have a strategic role, but this is why I tell you this should all be done. All strategic roles that have a necessity of national security must be done under the United States Navy. Don't forget, the United States Navy has a combatant force called the Marine Corps, that they're actually boots on the ground. So if there's a need for having boots on the ground as a strategic option, it needs to be done under the Navy, not the Army. That when there is a need for actually plussing up to fight a war, then that needs to be done under the militia. And I'll tell you what, if we actually had true militias that were designed under this Constitution the way it was, that every county would have, you know, a militia in service, and you got to remember that the federal government's responsibility is to pay for this, to pay for their training, to pay for their equipping and all of that. That's what it says in Article 1, Section 8. They're not supposed to be paying for your sheriff's, you know, plus-ups of law enforcement, you know, weaponizing them with military gear in city municipalities. This is to be done as a part of the militia design, that the people actually have these things. I'm going to tell you something, folks. If we actually maintained the militia, we would not have gone down this path of having rampant crime, because everybody would have been held accountable to actually enforcing the law. Because that's the militia. That is everybody. You have your active reserves, and then who's the inactive reserves? The rest of us. So you may not be in the militia, but you know what? If you get caught with a crime, you could be out of the militia and you could lose your rights. And I believe I've said this before, it's way too easy to maintain citizenship. We need to start holding people accountable. You start crossing lines, you start committing crimes, and you start doing these things where we can't trust you to be a part of the militia, then why should you be a citizen? You shouldn't be able to vote. And so there lies the rub. We've marginalized the importance of what it means to be a citizen and how we're all supposed to be supporting the Constitution. This is why we have all of these counter-constitutional activists, these Bolsheviks, and all these people that are insurgents against our constitutional republic and against that constitution. This should never be happening here. Anyway, as we move forward, this is what we have regarding exclusive legislation in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, the Congress shall have the power for exclusive legislation within the said district. And I'm not citing it, but that's basically what it's stating. And so Dr. Taylor said this. He asked, why there was not to be a federal town over which Congress is to exercise exclusive legislation. Mr. Strong said, every gentleman must think that the erection of a federal town was necessary, wherein Congress might retain or remain protected from insult. A few years ago, said the honorable gentleman, Congress had to remove because they were not protected by the authority of the state in which they were in, which they were then sitting. He then asked, this convention, though convened but for a short period, did not think it was necessary that they should have the power to protect themselves from insult. Much more so must they think it necessary to provide Congress, considering they are to be a permanent body. So as we move forward here, Mr. Honorable Davis says this in response. He says, said it was necessary that Congress should have a permanent residence, and that it was the intention of Congress under the Confederation to erect a federal town. He asked, would Massachusetts or any other state wish to give to New York or the state of which Congress shall sit the power to influence the proceedings, which was to act for the benefit of the whole by leaving them liable to the outrage of the citizens in such states? Mr. Taylor then asked, why it need be 10 miles square? And it didn't need to be. It needed to be no greater than 10 miles square. So Mr. Taylor was making the presumption that it was going to be, and today it's not. As a matter of fact, Virginia has basically taken back its part of the federal District of Columbia. They said, we're done with this. So this is why you only see the federal dole going to the District of Columbia, which is really in Maryland. And whether 1 mile should not be sufficient, said, this is what Mr. Strong said. He said, Congress was not to exercise jurisdiction over a district of 10 miles, but one not exceeding 10 miles square. Mr. Stillman said that whatever were the limits of the district, it would depend on the secession of the legislature of one of the states, if not two, and in this case it was two, with Virginia and Maryland. Mr. Dench said that he wished further light on the subject. And actually, see, this was, I think, the good part of this. By putting D.C. in between two states, it actually kind of maintained this concept. Because what would have happened if D.C. would have been smack dab in the middle of Virginia? They would have had to put it on an edge of a state, and actually creating it to where it was on the edge of two states kind of even created a more neutral ground than, you know, it being predominantly on one state or within one state entirely, like a donut hole in the state. Anyway, Mr. Dench said he wished further light on the subject, but that from the words, we the people, in the first clause ordaining this Constitution, he thought it was an actual consolidation of the states, and that, if he was not mistaken, the moment it took place, a dissolution of state governments would also take place. See, this is how, you know, and this is towards the very end. These ideas were still perpetuating from these anti-federalists. So General Brooks of Lincoln basically then responded to Mr. Dench and said, to consider the idea suggested by the gentleman last speaking that this Constitution would produce a dissolution of the state governments or a consolidation of the whole, which in his opinion, he said, was ill-founded or rather a loose idea. In the first place, he says, that the Congress under this Constitution cannot be organized without repeated acts of the legislatures of the several states. In other words, the state senators required the state legislatures to actually man and staff their Senate. And therefore, if the creating power is dissolved, the body cannot be created. It cannot exist. In the second place, says the general, it is impossible the general government can exist unless the governments of the several states are forever existing, as the qualifications of the electors and the federal representatives are to be the same as those electors for the most numerous branch of the state legislature. It was therefore, he said, impossible that the state governments should be annihilated by the general government, and was, he said, strongly implied from that part of the section under debate which Congress's power to exercise exclusive jurisdiction over the federal town, they shall have it over no other place. In other words, he was clearly pointing out that Congress would not have the power, exclusive legislation, over the United States or over any state, only over this little federal town that they were to operate. And so when it came to Congress doing business, as the federal town grew, one would think that Congress would be more involved in the management of that federal town than unconstitutionally creating a city, a mayor, and these government agencies, entities underneath them. When, and this is good, this is General Books of Lincoln going on and saying, when we attend to the Constitution, we shall see, the general says, that the powers to be given to Congress amount to only a consolidation of strength of the Union, and that private rights are not consolidated. The general mentioned the rights which Congress could not infringe upon, and said that the power to define what was treason was much less than is vested in the legislature of this state by our own Constitution, as it was confined in the third section of the article to levy war or adhering to and conforming enemies only. He mentioned the restraint upon Congress in the punishment of treason and compared it to the extended powers lodged in the Parliament of Great Britain on like crimes, and concluded by observing that as the United States guarantee to each state a republican form of government, the state governments were effectually secured as though this Constitution should never be in force. Then the Honorable Mr. King basically replied and said to the inquiry respecting a federal town that there was now no place for Congress to reside in, and that it was necessary that they should have a permanent residence where to establish a proper archives in which they may deposit treaties, state papers, deeds, and secessions, and etc. Mr. Singletary then said that all gentlemen had said about the Bill of Rights to the Constitution was that what is written, but he thought it were giving up all power and that the states will be like towns in this state. Towns, he said, have a right to lay taxes, to raise money, and states possibly have the same. We now have, said he, a good Republican Constitution, and we do not want it guaranteed to us. He did not understand what the gentleman meant by Congress guaranteeing a Republican form of government. He wished that they would not play round the subject with their fine stories like a fox trap, but come to it. Why don't they say that Congress will guarantee our state constitution? There you go. And see, this kind of shows how Mr. Singletary, the Honorable Mr. Singletary, you know, had maybe some limited capacity in understanding this. And it's not that complicated that the federal government, the general government, was a service-providing government of the services of national security in protecting life and in protecting property. So that's why they had national security and they had the responsibility over foreign trade, trade of what was to go out and not taxing it, but making sure that we weren't supporting, you know, because some of the states were supporting our enemies. And so the federal government would basically determine who would be the hostile states and so forth. And that was actually not really determined by, you know, this isolated people. The people coming from the states would actually, and would rationally, if they're staying within the framework of the Constitution, they would actually develop very strong strategies of, you know, how we were to protect America and how to move forward it with these limited capacities. But when you gave them all the power, this is how they're waging economic warfare on us now, because they have power that they're exercising power that they do not constitutionally have. And this is why they're exercising and deploying strategies that actually hurt us and make us more and more vulnerable unconstitutionally, because there's nothing constitutional about the laws, the taxation, the spending, and what they are doing. There's very little that is constitutional to what they're doing. It's not that some of the stuff isn't. It's just such a minority, and they're trying to get us to believe that we're becoming bankrupt with the way our government is. Well, our government is acting and is outside the Constitution. Therefore, those things are not legitimate. Which is why we have to control the narrative when separatists, or I should say nationalists, or sovereign citizens stand up and say, hey, the Constitution and this government is the problem. They're wrong. And I can't be emphatic enough. They are wrong. The Constitution is not being exercised by this government. Everything that is unconstitutional is actually designed now and being used to hurt us and to destroy us. So as we go down a little bit further, we now hit Wednesday, January 29th, and this is what has to be said by Mr. Dawes regarding common law. Said he did not see that the right of trial by jury was taken away by the article. The word court does not, either by a particular technical construction, exclude of the use of a jury to try facts. When people in common language talk of a trial at the Court of Common Pleas or the Supreme Judicial Court, do they not include the branches and members of the court, the jurors as well as the judges? They certainly do, whether they mention the jurors expressly or not. Our state legislature have construed the word court in the same way that they have given appeals from a justice of peace to the Court of Common Pleas and from thence the Supreme Court without saying anything of the jury. But in cases which almost time out of mind have been tried without jury, there the jurisdiction is given expressly to the justices of a particular court, as may be instanced by suits upon the absconding act, so-called. Gentlemen have compared the article under consideration that the power which the British claimed and we resisted at the Revolution, namely the power of trying Americans without a jury, but surely was no parallel in the case. It was criminal cases in which they attempted to make the abuse of power. Honorable Dalton, because that's the, no, the Judge Dana, well, maybe it's Dalton, but anyway, Mr. D mentioned one example of this, which, though young, he well remembered, and that was the case of Nickerson, the pirate who was tried without a jury, and whose judges were the governors of Massachusetts and some neighboring provinces. Together, the Admiral Monteague and some gentlemen of distinction, although this trial was without jury, yet as it was a trial upon the civil law, there was not much more clamor about it as otherwise there may have been. But still, it was disagreeable to the people and was one of their complaints. But the trial by jury was not attempted to be taken from the civil causes. It was no object of power whether one subject's property was lessened while another's was increased, nor can it be an object from the federal legislature. What interest can they have in constituting a judiciary to proceed in civil cases without a trial by jury? In criminal cases by the proposed government, there must be a jury. Now, we'll stop right there. And we're going to go into a break. So when we come back, we'll just pick it up from there. So anyway, We will be right back with what Mr. Dawes has to say about common law and the nuances between courts that don't require a jury and courts that actually do and why they require a jury. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so what we're getting into here is how Mr. Dawes kind of lays out this argument that the reason why the federal government was not to establish what they did was they guaranteed when it came down to any type of trial where $20 or more was the subject of the fine, then they were guaranteed a right to a trial by jury, which is basically a common law right, instead of standing in front of a justice. Now, when I say this, go read the 7th Amendment, then read the 14th Amendment, Section 1, that says no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges of a U.S. citizen. The U.S. citizen has this right that is protected by the 7th Amendment. And so, you know, since I'm here, let me go ahead and dive into the Bill of Rights and the 7th Amendment and the right to trial by jury. And this is what it says. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy trial. So in other words, that is basic common law. That in a criminal prosecution by the federal government, they were to exercise a trial. So just that's what we're talking about, the criminal and then civil. And then he says, in suits at common law, where the value, in other words, this is a civil law, not the civil law law, but a, let's just call this, what do they call that? So you have criminal law, and then you have, it's civil. I believe that the concept is, it's not like, you know, they're determining whether you've done damage or something, and, you know, so it's not necessarily something that they would actually have had in those days, that they would have a trial by jury. But because, and this is what he was saying that it varied so much between the states that the federal government couldn't actually say what the common law was, because the common law was different in states. And so the common law of Boston was not the same as the common law of Virginia. But in the 7th Amendment, it says this, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. In other words, this isn't criminal law. It's you've done harm. You've done, not that you've violated somebody, but, you know, you've caused, you know, there's going to be a penalty or a fee because you've violated some city statute or something like that. Not that you're a criminal. They don't haul you away to jail because you've committed a traffic violation. But it says right here, in suits at common law where the value in controversy, traffic violations is under common law, shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. And so when you look at the 7th Amendment, this is what the 7th Amendment kind of helped inject to kind of deal with this very specific concern. And this is what he says. It is asked, why is not the Constitution as explicit in securing the right of jury in a civil as in criminal cases? The answer is because it was not out of the power. So just to be clear, they actually had civil cases back then, not criminal. In other words, they weren't trying to, you know, you for murder. They weren't trying you for stealing or robbery. That was criminal cases. But when you did something or you neglected to do something, did that cause harm where they said, you know what, we believe you've caused harm and this is all about money. This is not about putting you in jail. And so this is what they go on. Is it because it was out of the power of the convention? The several states differ so widely in their modes of trial, some states using a jury in causes wherein other states employ only their judges, that the convention have very wisely left it to the federal legislature to make regulations as shall, as far as possible, accommodate the whole. Thus, our own state constitution authorizes the general court to erect judicatories, but leaves the nature, number, and extent of them wholly to the discretion of the legislature. The Bill of Rights indeed secures the trial by jury in civil causes, except in cases where a contrary practice has obtained. Such a clause as this, some gentlemen wish, were inserted to be proposed in the Constitution, but such a clause would be abused in that Constitution, as it has been clearly stated that by the honorable gentleman from Charleston, Mr. Gorham, because the, quote, exception of cases where a jury have not heretofore been used, close quote, would include almost all cases that could not be mentioned when applied to the states, for they have severely differed in the kinds of causes which they have tried without jury. So to be clear, they did actually have cases and civil cases where they were not tried by jury. But what the Constitution did is the federal government would not allow a person to actually be tried for a civil case without being tried by jury if the punishment or if the sum of the suit was $20 or more. Well, that's still in the Constitution. And if you're getting a traffic ticket for $20 or more, then you have a right to a trial by jury because the 14th Amendment applies that right. Now, see, the states have always made it so that they can make more money off of you. And really, when you think about traffic laws are really to help preserve and protect life. Taking away somebody's, you know, it's one thing, you know, if you're a repeat offender where you're speeding all the time, you're causing these problems, to take away one's license for a period of time and increase the, you know, the suspension of one's license as they, if they're still chronic when they get their license back, to increase it so that people understand that, you know, this is not about money. This is about getting you to behave properly in protecting life and preserving property, protecting other people's property. So anyway, Mr. Heath then goes into this dialogue regarding new states and slavery. And this is what he says. Mr. President, by my indisposition and absence, I have lost several important opportunities. I have lost the opportunity of expressing my sentiments with a candid freedom on some of the paragraphs of the system which we have lain heavy on our mind. I have lost the opportunity of expressing my warm approbation on some of the paragraphs. I've lost the opportunity of asking some questions for my own information touching some paragraphs, which would naturally have occurred as the system unfolded. I have lost the opportunity of hearing those judicious, enlightening, and convincing arguments which have been advanced during the investigation of the system. This is my misfortune, and I must bear it. The paragraph respecting the migration or the importation of such persons as any state now exists shall think proper to admit, etc., is one of those considered during my absence, and I have not heard anything on the subject save what has been mentioned this morning. But I think the gentlemen who have spoke have carried the matter rather far, too far on both sides. Excuse me. I apprehend that it is not in our power to do anything for or against those who are in slavery in the southern states. No gentleman within these walls detests every idea of slavery more than I do. It is generally detested by the people of this commonwealth, and I ardently hope that the time will soon come when our brethren in the southern states will view it as we do and put a stop to it. But to this, we have no right to compel them. Remember, I've mentioned this on the scale of liberty, that compulsion is evil. We need to get there on our own way. Now, when it comes to freeing and giving a person those liberties, I honestly believe that we do have a responsibility. And if you feel that way, then, you know, doing what we could, and the Constitution would have provided it. But the way they made politics, it forced us to go down the path of the Civil War. Anyway, two questions naturally arise. If we ratify the Constitution, should we do anything by our act to hold blacks in slavery, or shall we become the partakers of other men's sins? I think neither of them. Each state is sovereign and independent to a certain degree, and the states have a right, and they regulate their own internal affairs as to themselves appears proper. And shall we refuse to eat or drink or to be united with those who do not think or act just as we do? Surely not, where we are not in the case partakers of other men's sins. For nothing do we voluntarily encourage the slavery of our fellow men. A restriction is laid on the federal government, which could not be avoided. A union take place. The federal convention went as far as they could. The migration importation is confined to the states now. Existing only new states cannot claim it. Congress, by their ordinance in erecting new states, sometime declared that the new states shall be Republican, and there shall be no slavery in them. But whether those in slavery in the southern states will be emancipated after the year 1808, I do not pretend to determine. I rather doubt it. And so this is interesting because, you know, he doesn't look at the way Pennsylvania and Wilson kind of laid out this mathematical, because obviously this gentleman, Mr. General Heath, wasn't a delegate for Massachusetts at the convention. So he's just seeing this stuff. It's not like they had CNN, you know, and all this misinformation or even good information. They didn't have a media system. So everything was traveled by word of mouth. They didn't have recordings, and actually, you know, so everything had to be written down, and they were very dependent on scribes to keep accurate notes as best as possible. And so anyway, what he points out is that this really was a state issue, but it was contained that new states joining the Union being Republican in form could not have these things. And this also incorporated because at the point in time the Constitution was written, Congress, he points out that Congress created a law that in admitting new states, is called the Northwest Ordinance, none could be slave states. And in Congress's first year in session, they adopted that and started using that in admitting new states into the Union. So when Louisiana came in, it chose to be slave. But however, this is one of those states that they actually should have stepped up and said, no, you can't do that, had they lived by the Northwest Ordinance. But the Northwest Ordinance was not and could not have been a constitutional act, because the Constitution didn't really clearly dictate. States were sovereign. States could dictate where the federal government and where slavery was to die. Well, it was the political hatchings of these evil men in Congress. Actually, the Senate initiated this concept of the, excuse me, the Missouri Compromise, which basically foreordained all southern states must be slave states, which was an apostasy to the Constitution, for the federal government of the Constitution to foreordain and dictate to a state something that a state actually had its own, I'll just say it, it had its own self-destiny and determination. It had the ability to choose for itself. Now, think about it this way, that even though the federal government, this Missouri Compromise, existed, what would have happened had the states actually that had, like Missouri, they created it because the Congress required them to be a slave state. And then a year or two later, they convened a convention to rewrite their Constitution, and they abolished slavery. What would have happened? Congress may have required them to come in as a slave state, but Congress cannot control what the state chooses to do for itself as long as it is a Republican form of government. And this is why I'm telling you that state constitutional conventions are going to be necessary when once we start actually cleaning up and getting ready to prepare these pressures on the federal government. There may be some states that will be already positioning before they've convened a convention, because I think it's best to convene these conventions after we, you know, start applying these constraints and getting the federal government back into check. It is far more important to reel the federal government in, because if they fall, they take us with them. But and then we can worry about the states later. This is why, you know, we got to get our counties back, and we can do certain things at the county level. But once we get our state back, that state's primary focus should be this, you know, getting the federal government into compliance by using Republic Review. So the next one, Mr. Jarvis now talks about, and this is on the Wednesday, January 30th, talks about amendments and religion. This is, sir, another view which I have long since taken of this subject, which has produced the fullest conviction in my own mind in favor of receiving the government which we have now in contemplation. Should it be rejected, I beg gentlemen would observe that a concurrence of all states must be had before a new convention can be called to form another constitution. But the present articles provide upon 9 states concurring in alteration or amendment to the proposed either by Congress any future convention that this alteration shall be part of the Constitution, equally powerful and obligatory with any other part. If it be alleged that this union is not likely to happen, will it be more likely that a union of a greater number of concurring sentiments may be had, as must be in the case we reject the Constitution in hopes of a better. But that this is practicable, we may safely appeal to the history of this country as a proof. In the last 20 years, we have united against Britain. We have united in calling the late Federal Convention. We may certainly unite again in such alterations as reason shall appear to be important for the peace and happiness of America. In the Constitution of this state, the article providing for alterations is limited in its operation to a given time. But in the present Constitution, the article is perfectly at large, unconfined at any period, and may admit of measures being taken in any moment after it is adopted. In this point, it has undoubtedly the advantage. I shall not sit down, sir, without repeating that it is clearly more difficult for 12 states to agree to another convention than for 9 to unite in favor of amendments, so as it certainly better to receive the present Constitution in the hope of its being amended, that it would be rejected altogether with perhaps the vain expectation of obtaining a more agreeable than the present. I see no fallacy in the argument, Mr. President, but if there is, permit me to call upon the gentleman to point out, in order that it may be corrected, for at present time, it seems to me, of such force as to give me entire satisfaction. So, you know, it was a difficult way of speaking, because he kind of roundaboutly talked, but he clearly was basically pointing out that if they fail to ratify this because they think that they would get a better constitution the next time around, just remember, it requires all of the states to call for a convention. And so that's why they had the convention, because all of the states did call for the convention. And they all showed up, and then Rhode Island immediately went home. They said, we're not going to do this. And at that point, you know, one would say, well, since one state, you know, pulled out, do they have to pull out? No. Because all of the states did call for it, and they could actually conclude this, even though Rhode Island left. Now, this is what he says on religion. In the conversation on Thursday on the sixth article, which provides that, quote, no religious test shall be required as a qualification of any office, etc., several gentlemen urged that it was a departure from the principles of our forefathers, who came here for the preservation of their religion, and that it would admit deists and atheists into the general government, and people being apt to intimate the examples of the court, these principles would be disseminated, and the course a corruption of moral ensue. Gentlemen on the other side applaud the liberality of the clause and presented it in striking colors. The impropriety is almost impiety of the requisition of a test as practiced in Great Britain and elsewhere. In this conversation, the following is the substance of the observations of Reverend Mr. Shute. Mr. President, to object to the latter part of the paragraph under consideration, which excludes religious test, is, I am sensible, very popular for most men somehow are rigidly tenacious in their own sentiments and religion, and disposed to impose them on others as the standard of truth. If in my sentiments upon the point in view, I should differ from some in this honorable body, I only wish from them the exercise of that candor, which with true religion is adopted to inspire the honest and well-disposed mind. To establish religious tests as qualifications for office in the proposed federal constitution, it appears to me, sir, would be attended with injurious consequences to some individuals with no advantage to the whole. By the injurious consequences to the individuals, I mean that some who in every other respect are qualified to fill some of the posts in government will be excluded by their not being able to stand the religious test, which I take to be a privation of part of their civil rights. A deprivation is what he should have said, but they didn't use that word back then. Anyway, nor is there to me any conceivable advantage, sir, that would result from such a test. Unprincipled and dishonest men do not hesitate to subscribe anything that may open the way for their advancement and put them into a situation the better to execute their base and iniquitous designs. Honest men alone, therefore, however well qualified to serve the public, would be excluded by it, and their country be deprived of the benefit of their abilities. This is how Feinstein, this is how these senators, these godless senators, have opposed, by using religious tests, they actually go after people for their religious beliefs. And this is why, you know, she should have been removed. Actually, I believe that as we start moving forward and people want to seek their justice, Feinstein should be, she should lose all of her emoluments, all of her retirement, everything that she gained from being a public servant on, you know, I'll just say, ingratiating herself by using all of the money that she put in her own hands from government, by giving her husband all of these advantages, the TARP bailout. I mean, when we look at Feinstein and the corruption that in her service as a senator, All of these things need to be fully rooted out if you really want a pound of flesh. The fact is, we need to move forward and obtain our liberties. Then if you want your pound of flesh, we need to do that. But if you're actually seeking a pound of flesh, there are people that violated the Constitution by actually using religious tests, and they got away with it, and they've been doing it for years. They have been doing it for years, because in the 60s and the 70s is when they started deploying religious tests against Christians. And it was actually even before then, with the Supreme Court, with this, you know, Hugo Black and his 33-degree Mason paradigm, you know, started basically creating laws that established anti-Christ or anti-Christian laws and an anti-Christian church, enforcing secular godlessness upon all people. This was in the early 20th century. There was the Scopes trial and all of that. But anyway, I digress. So moving on, Mr. Dawes says, in this great and extensive empire, there is and will be a variety of sentiments and religion among inhabitants. Upon the plan of a religious test, the question I think must be, who shall be excluded from national trust? Whatever answer bigotry might suggest, the dictates of candor and equity, I conceive, will be none. Far from lighting my clarification and confidence to men of my own denomination and religion, I suppose that I believe, sir, that there are worthy characters among men of every denomination, among Quakers, Baptists, the Church of England, the Papists, in other words, the Catholics, and even those who have no other guide in the way to virtue and heaven than the dictates of natural religion or the laws of nature, nature's God. I must therefore think, sir, that the proposed plan of government in this particular is wisely constructed, that as all have equally claim to the blessings of the government under which they live and which they support, so none should be excluded from them for being of any particular denomination and religion. The presumption is that the eyes of the people will be upon the faithful in the land, and from a regard to their own safety, they will choose for their rulers men of known abilities, of known probity, of good moral character. The Apostle Peter tells us that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is acceptable to him. And I know of no reason why men of such character in a community, whatever denomination, religion, cateris paribus, and I guess that's Latin, of course, with other suitable qualifications, should not be acceptable to the people, and why they may not be employed by them with safety and advantage in the important offices of government. The exclusion of a religious test in the proposed Constitution, therefore, clarity appears to me, sir, to be in favor of this adoption. And so, and it's interesting that clearly in the Massachusetts Puritan paradigm, they were becoming really ardent supporters of maintaining or keeping, you know, these religious tests from being embraced and being inflicted. But how did we get there? Oh, well, if it's godlessness, it's not religion. And I'm telling you, that was the biggest deceit Satan got away with here in America, by creating this godless church and this Antichrist church that the federal government did. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.